Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And we are joined by a very special guest. I'm just going to refer to him as the former voice of the Sioux Falls Canaries and St. Paul Saints. But one of the radio broadcasters for the Minnesota Twins, the biggest surprise in baseball this year, the Minnesota Twins, Chris Atterbury. Chris, welcome to the program.
Yeah, are we the biggest surprise in baseball?
That's my thought. I mean, unless you know something I don't.
No, we'll take it. I'll take biggest surprise in baseball. I think that's fine. The funny thing is, the Twins are legitimately a good team, and they've played legitimately good baseball against the only other like five good teams in the American League. And yet, people still are shocked on either coast that the Twins are even remotely good. The A's were just in here, and they swaggered in here with their, you know, nobody respects us thing. And we're like, well, you guys aren't good. You're not going to make the playoffs. I mean, you know, the Twins are just a function of a bad division. And then we played like four meat grinder games and split with them. It's really interesting. And then the Boston Riders last night, when the Boston Red Sox are pummeling the Yankees, in large part because the Yankees got in a bloodbath three-game series here in Minnesota and showed up at 4 a.m, Boston Riders are like, these ain't the Twinkies. You're not coming back on us. I'm like, you know, we beat you 2 out of 3 games, so maybe it would just kind of temper the attitude a little bit. But, yeah, no, it's a good team. And I don't think we're shocked here because I think we thought we had a bunch of players who were entering their prime. We added a new manager. We added a guy like Nelson Cruz, which makes you better in every aspect of your organization. And so I don't think we're shocked, but pleasantly happy with where we are and not satisfied quite yet with where we are.
Okay, so it's a function of great timing because you have guys like Byron Buxton who are entering into their prime. You throw Nelson Cruz into the mix. There have been other acquisitions that have certainly played a role in it, but, I mean, it's not smoke and mirrors at this point. You're 100 games in and still playing 600 ball. The other acquisition, I guess, offseason acquisition, is a guy who's still young by managerial standards, Rocco Baldelli. What do you see from him that is different than what you had seen previously?
Well, so Rocco he's the youngest manager at 37, and he's your classic modern manager. The game is different now, and where you've got to be in a straight line, not just from your GM chair to your manager, but also like through your entire developmental process in the minor leagues. That's just the way this thing is going. And so you have to be progressive. You have to be open-minded. And then the role of the manager has changed from the, you know, I'm the sheriff and here's how it's going to be guy, to the communicator. So you've got a floor full of analysts and you've got concepts of how you want to build a team and different things that you want to utilize and maximize. And then you need somebody who can sift all that down and have the respective players and communicate with them in a fashion where they don't feel like, you know, you're feeding the geese for pate. They feel like they're being respected and that their opinions are being heard. And that's what he's really, really good at. And his staff, Derek Shelton's really good too. But it's also a function of, so when Molly went to the playoffs 2 years ago, the team kind of probably arrived a little before it was ready. And then they regressed last year way more than they should have, in large part due to the fact that they just didn't have players. They missed Polanco for half a year because he got popped for PEDs. They missed Buxton and Snow essentially for the entire year. Well, it's those three guys plus Kepler, plus Rosario, plus Barrios, who was an all-star last year. That's your core. And so they're all healthy for the most part this year, and they're all entering that 25 to 27-year-old window when they should be at their peak. And so throw those guys, add in the veterans, sprinkle the veterans around them like Nelson Cruz, the emergence of Mitch Garber, who's part of that core as well, and then add Rocco's touch, his deft touch with how he treats these guys, and it's a pretty good combination. It's still short on pitching, but that's true of every single team in baseball.
Well, the thing that's jumped out to me, Chris, as I look at the numbers, are the outburst of home runs. The Twins have hit a major league leading 199 home runs this season. That's 25 more than any other team. They've got 11 players who've hit at least 9 home runs. What can explain this change, this outburst of home runs over there?
Well, Rob Manfred's baseball factory is probably a big part of it. And then we've got good players, you know, and there's a lot of bad pitching in the league. I mean, those are, if you want to really be truthful, those are all the factors that go into it together. Last night they hit 5 homers. It's the 9th time they've done that this year. First team in baseball history to hit, to have 9 games of 5 homers or more. They're on pace to shatter the all-time home run record, which will probably last half a season. The balls are part of it. They are flying all over the place. These are Titleists. The fact that Major League Baseball owns the factory and still can't explain what happened to them makes them like the worst supply chain managers in history. So that's part of it. The ball definitely carries better. But that's the nature of the swing now, right, is that we're going to get out in front of the ball, and we're gonna hit it in the air, and we're going to hit it hard. That's your plan. Now, the thing that has changed is when this launch revolution started with Billy Beane and the A's saying, wow, everybody's throwing sinkers and sliders. Let's get under the ball and lift it. You know, there's more money to be made in the air than on the ground. When that started, they were sacrificing strikeouts for home runs. And then as we saw 2 years ago first with the Astros, wow, suddenly they lead the world in home runs and they don't strike out. And then last year, if you look at the best teams in baseball were Boston, Houston, and Cleveland. They all hit bombs. They didn't strike out at all, and they stole a bunch of bases because suddenly nobody did that except them. And we were hiring catchers who couldn't throw because all we wanted them to do was frame. And so the Twins have managed to hit a ton of home runs, and they don't strike out very much. And that's, again, the big misconception. Everyone's like, oh, they have to strike out to hit bombs. And they don't. And they play in a very neutral ballpark. They've actually hit more home runs on the road than they have at home. What they do in terms of how their home runs come is they're 1 through 9, everybody can hit. And then they wear out starters. And then they get into the meaty long relief, and then they crush it. They hit more home runs there than it's third time through the order than most clubs. They make really good adjustments. So the Yankees were just here, like I said. And the Yankees had only had, I think, 17 games all year where their starter didn't go 5. They didn't get a starter through 4 innings against us in 3 games. And they won 2 of those games. And that just takes its toll. And as poor as some of the division is, with Detroit, Kansas City, the White Sox all rebuilding, the Twins have played the fewest games against the Central than anybody. Now, sure, they hit a billion home runs against Baltimore, but you know what? Boston and Tampa and New York get to play Baltimore 19 times. That should be 200 home runs right there. So you can't just say it's schedule. I think it's just good hitters in their prime, taking advantage of a league where the pitching hasn't been very good top to bottom, and the balls are like cue balls.
Joined by Chris Atterbury, one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins. And so if you're Rob Manfred and you can't explain why this is going on
or won't.
But, I mean, everybody sort of agrees that this is a challenge and the pace of play within the games is a challenge. You know, you're talking the Angels played 6 hours and 19 minutes last night against the Orioles. So all of this is a challenge. And the game to the common fan is by and large lost because it's turned into this sort of glorified home run derby. Is it as easy as you just change the baseballs and put the genie back in the jar or what?
You know, I think it's more complicated than that, and I also think the narrative isn't that simple. You know, people keep telling us that fans don't like baseball and young fans hate the game and they don't have the attention span for it, and yet our attendance is up leaps and bounds, and we sold the place out 5 times last week, and our TV and radio ratings are skyrocketing through the roof.
That's because of you, though. That's you.
And so, it's probably mostly me.
That's the Atterbury effect,
yes. Being me, so I don't think that people don't like it. You can't tell me that nobody likes it because they keep coming. And so I think that narrative is a little bit twisted. I think the thing we always say is pace of play, and I know the manager loves that, or Commissioner loves to say pace of play and we're losing fans. But the big issue, if you really drill down, is they're fine with the game in the ballparks. They're concerned about the game on all the billion different platforms that they want to take money from. How is it on TV? Oh, it's too long on TV. Oh, we're not on YouTube and we're not on Facebook Live and we can't maximize our dollars on all of these other digital channels. That's a different game altogether than the game that you see in the ballpark where the commissioner has even admitted in the ballpark we're fine, but now we're trying to tailor it to this digital audience as opposed to the fans in the stands. And I think that's where you can't really have it both ways. You don't get to complain about both ways, or you don't get to use it as a wedge in an increasingly vitriolic relationship with the union where you want to flex your muscles and dance around the union every time you win a little battle. So I think that's part of it. I don't think when we say pace of play, we mean pace of play. I think pace of play is code for terrible baseball. I think it's code for people who can't throw strikes. And I think it's code for people who got rushed to the major leagues because they're cheaper. There's a bunch of, you could put a team together of guys right now who have 5 to 7 years of major league experience and are professional players who can throw strikes, make contact, throw to the right base, and do all these fundamental baseball things. But you're not going to win the World Series with them. So why am I going to pay them $5 million a year when I can pay $550,000 to a rookie with some talent and try to utilize him until he becomes expensive and then dismiss him? So I think that's more of what's going on, is there are players, honestly, who just they've rushed to the big leagues. Because if you're one of these rebuilding teams, which constitutes about, I would say, 22 of the teams in the league, they're not going to pay to be average or okay. They're going to stay cheap and grow talent. And there's a lot of talent, don't get me wrong, but it's not really cultured talent or nurtured talent. And all you have to do is look through the middle relief corps of pretty much every team in baseball and see that what we're having a problem with isn't pace of play. It's ball one, ball two, 2-1, 3-1, 3-2, foul ball, walk, because it's bad baseball. So I think that's bad baseball nobody wants to watch. When we have a four-hour game in the World Series, it's an instant classic. When we have a four-hour game between the Orioles and the Tigers in August, it's a problem for the game and fans don't want to watch it. You don't get that in both ways.
Yeah, it is tough, and the pitching changes have certainly not helped. You watch a game on TV, and I guess it was meant to be leisurely to a degree, but there is something nice about a game being done in 2.5-3 hours. The game that you see, and you probably don't watch a whole lot of high school baseball because you're watching big league games every day. Mm-hmm. The game that you see still at a youth level, once they move to the big field or once they are at a high school level, is sort of what baseball was even 5 years ago, where they didn't.
Yeah.
They got, nobody really has the ability to put the ball over the fence, so they're not going to even try. It's a matter of how do we sort of play that chess match and try to scratch runs across, which I think there is a lot of excitement for the fans in a home run. That's something that doesn't really require a whole lot of explanation to anybody. A triple is a little bit more nuanced and more exciting, and me and Hanson get excited about guys hitting cutoffs and, a guy like, all right, is he going to stretch the double into a triple? We get geeked out about sacrifice bunts, stolen bases, but that sort of stuff to an average fan who's got an attention span of 5 seconds is kind of lost.
Well, and I think it's still the skill set's lost because the way players are acquired, first of all, I never complain about teams trying to win, like figuring out the best ways to win, right? If you can maximize your chance to win a game by having your pitcher play first base and then come back in and pitch again.
Oh, dude, I love that.
You're right. That is your right. It's just like in college. You can run the option if you think it's your best way to utilize your talent, or you can run the spread. And I think that different brands of baseball make for more exciting baseball. We hate playing the Royals because they still play like it's 1977. They're all super fast. They catch everything, and they run all over the place. And baseball, through its history, is all about the back and forth, right? Like, now everybody throws four-seamers up and nobody throws sinkers because they changed the swing to hit the sinker. Well, someone's going to change the swing to hit the four-seamer, right? And then someone's going to start doing what Matt Olson does in Oakland and bunt against the shift for doubles. And then you're going to have to not shift anymore. And the game goes back and forth, and that's how baseball moves on. But the players that play in the big leagues and get drafted and get scouted, what do? They don't hit the cutoff guy in the high school game. They go to a showcase, they get three swings, and the guy who hits the ball the farthest gets everybody's attention. In the same way, the pitchers don't go to a tryout or a showcase or a travel all-star team to show off their cunning command or their beautiful fadeaway changeup. They got to pop the radar gun or nobody's going to talk to them. And it becomes an issue because those are the guys now that are playing. And they've never had to, A, play for a real team because they just ship around to showcases. And they don't understand, I think, a lot of the time, score and inning and situational baseball because they've never played in a team environment. They've been so good for so long that they've just been a hired gun like Paladin, going around and playing every weekend for somebody different. And I think that's part of where the overall fabric of winning baseball goes away, because what was winning baseball for years was about continuity and subtlety, and those things don't get you drafted. Velocity gets you drafted, power gets you drafted. And now I think we're seeing with more of the data, I'm going to draft Hanson because his spin rate's good, not his velocity necessarily. And we think we can work with that. Or we like what the bat blaster sensors are telling us about his wrists. And so we're taking it to different places, but we're still largely taking the raw talent. For all the talk about, you know, how you can make yourself into a player like Justin Turner by changing your swing, that's still a ways away from being the norm, because the super talented people have access to the same stuff, and we're grabbing the guys who hit it far and throw it hard.
Well, you forget, too. I mean, you can say whatever you want about Justin Turner being made into a player by changing his swing, but it's not like he was working at Home Depot. He played at Cal State Fullerton.
He was a
major league player. Like, it was taking a step. And same thing with, like, a Max Muncy. Like, it's not like these dudes are waiting tables and all of a sudden they pick up another swing and voila, you're a major leaguer. Like, there was still something that made him, in the case of Turner, get recruited by one of the premier programs in the country, and then from there get drafted by somebody. It's just certain people adjust it at certain speeds. So joined by Chris Atterbury, one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins. Of course, you're an indie ball guy. One of the stories that is making the rounds now is robot umps in the Atlantic League. I can't wait to see the robotic version of Cowboy Joe West.
It's a funny story. I came into my studio like a month ago, and Cowboy Joe was sitting in my chair. He was going to have a little sit down with Dan Gladden, and I found out that Cowboy Joe West was the quarterback for Elon College, and they lost probably Division II national championship game to Wilbert Montgomery and Abilene Christian.
Seriously.
And I was like, all right, that's good for me. That's all I need to know today. I don't even need food for a week.
That's like that's legit. I mean, that requires a degree of athleticism. Like you wouldn't know that he has it now, but
no, you wouldn't. The robot I'm thinking is interesting. Why not try it? We all want it to be right. I mean, we were howling here the other day when Tyler Duffy struck out Luke Voit with a sick curveball and the rookie ump balled it. And it cost us, a lead in the eighth inning. I tend to lean on the side of I don't mind some human error in the game. I mean, it's humans trying to do something, and I think I don't mind if they mess up once in a while. Would robots ump solve everything, or does it just create a new batch of problems? You know, we talked about how we wanted a replay because we were going to get it right, and then we opened Pandora's box, and now if you make a great slide and you beat the ball to the base and then you come off for a split second millimeter and the guy holds the glove on you, then all of that great base running is an out because the eye in the sky. And I don't like that. So certainly when it goes against your team, you howl and you wish you had it, but I guess I can wait. I don't necessarily need to see robot umps. We got replay and I still don't think it gets it right very often with the way they've got it going. And I don't understand some of that. So I think, honestly, robot umps will just lead you to a new batch of issues, frankly. So I also think there's something to be said for the skill of, he's calling that pitch, but he's not calling that pitch.
Absolutely.
Oh, this guy doesn't call the high pitch, but he calls the low pitch. There's something to be said for the vast amount of knowledge and skill that a catcher and a pitcher have to understand and manipulate that. In the same way that I'm sad that they've taken one of the great parts of the game away at second base in terms of turning double plays, where second basemen no longer have to be ballerinas. They don't have to understand how to get rid of the ball and use the base to protect themselves and low bridge a guy. Like, they don't have to. This whole skill set that made Bill Mazeroski a Hall of Famer, now we don't need it. Can you hit some bombs and maybe move 2 feet to your left and 2 feet to your right and shift? Okay, good. You don't have to turn. Don't worry about your feet. And I think that bums me out because that's a really beautiful part of the game that has been lost. We've got to watch Jonathan Schoop play second all the time. And, boy, he's good at the bag. He's really, really, really good at the bag. And he's got a monster arm. And it's a part of the game that's gone now. And no one's out there working on footwork at second base because it's not part of the game. Because they decided Chase Utley made a bad slide, so everybody suffers. And there was already a rule in place for what Utley did to penalize him. And yet we had to change everything. So I'm really a little bit of a Luddite in terms of let's just change everything automatically. I think that gets a little knee-jerk for my liking.
Chris, I'm curious. There's a couple other rules changes that the Atlantic League is experimenting with. One of them is allowing a batter to steal first base on any wild pitch. Yeah. And then allowing batters to foul off a bunt with two strikes once and continue the at-bat without having be a strikeout. I'm curious about those potential rule changes and specifically being able to steal first after wild pitch, because talking about the Minnesota Twins catchers being able to frame pitches really well, I think it'll put more of an emphasis on catchers who can block. And, you know, I agree with you. It's fun to watch these rule changes to see how teams adjust and try to take advantage of the different rules and strategize. So what do you think about either of those potential rules changes?
Well, it's weird because the only reason like people hate shifts is because 100 years ago people lined up in a certain spot. And so we assume that that's just the way that it was intended from the heavens. And it's the same way with like the you can't bunt with two strikes thing. If you start thinking like, well, why? Why is a foul ball there a strike but not if I'm swinging? It's weird, right? Like, so it doesn't make sense even at the beginning. And yet I'm loath to change it because that's how it's been. And I feel like if you're trying to sacrifice yourself and you can't do it in two pitches, then I think the pitcher should be rewarded in some respect. But you shouldn't get to keep trying. It also goes back to what Paul Molitor told me, where he thought in this day and age of rising strikeouts, if you get to 0-2 and you were trying to bunt, everybody strikes out anyway. So why not try to bunt again and maybe just get better at bunting and bunt with two strikes when they go back into the shift and are giving you a hit. So I think there's another area where the rule change allows you to not have to get better at a skill, which I'm not a big fan of. I think stealing first is just stupid. I mean, why not just get fast guys and wait for them to throw to the backstop? Like, I don't know. I think the whole point is you're supposed to swing and hit the ball. And we talk about wanting to speed the game up, so make them swing. I mean, make them swing at pitches. And the way to speed the game up is have people throw strikes and to call strikes. And I think that trying to manufacture things like the intentional walk rule. I had the privilege of watching the last intentional walk that led to a run because our guy threw it to the backstop in a Twins game. Pat Dean was the name of the guy. I think it was Pat Dean. Might have been a different guy. We had a lot of guys that year. And he threw one to the backstop, and they scored a run, and we lost the game because he couldn't execute an intentional walk. Now he doesn't have to because we don't, God forbid, we have to be able to deliver an intentional walk. And then they give you the lip service if it's to speed the game up. Okay. When you hit one in the seats, just go back to the dugout. Save me the 30-second trot. We'd save hours, just on Big Poppy alone. If you hit one in the seats, then just go in the dugout. But no one's talking about changing that rule. So I think it's a lot of eyewash, and I think stealing first is, frankly, I think it's just kind of stupid.
Yeah, I do have to agree with you there. I mean, you think about other rules, too, like catchers blocking the plate. All right, the Buster Posey rule. There was something to be said. I don't know if Mike Scioscia has as long of a career as he did in the major leagues, if not for the fact that he was just able to withstand any possible hit at the plate.
Well, and we see a lot of times now where that it's actually made the game sloppier because catchers now have to just catch and sweep tag, and that leads to more, you know how hard that is with a ball coming from the outfield? It's really hard. And so now more balls get to the backstop, and, you know, it becomes a thing. So, I thought there were already rules in place. You can't cream a guy illegally on purpose without being penalized before. They never utilized the rule or executed it, but it was already in place, and they changed that one. And I just think, how much are you going to change? Like this, the relief pitcher one where you have to face three guys, like that changes the entire complexity of how you manage a game, a skill that people develop in terms of matching up, or careers of the Tony Sipps of the world are now out the door because it's going to save you. Pitching changes, it's going to lead to longer games because a guy has to face three batters when maybe he can barely get one out, and now there's going to be a longer inning. You're just going to have the pitching changes after three hits instead of after one. So I just don't think they're very well thought out. And I think anytime you hamper a team's ability to do what they feel is their best route to win a game, I think you're messing with the integrity of the product.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Not to mention, now can all those loogies sue for restrain a trade? I can't do it.
Are they doing what?
It's restrain a trade. Like, if you're not a left-handed one-out guy anymore because you can't get one out, like, it's hindering my ability. Does baseball lose its antitrust exemption? Like,
well, they won't, because the same guy who puts his arm around Sharon Robinson every April on Jackie Robinson Day signed a check to donate to white supremacist congressional people so that they could get reelected and maintain that antitrust exemption in Congress. They spend more money with lobbyists and politicians so that they don't have to spend the same amount of money paying minor leaguers like a living wage and insurance. So that's never going to change.
Yeah, it's still mind-boggling when you look at what some of those guys down in the low minors make. these are guys who, even though they're in the low minors, are among the best on the planet at what they do. And for them to get a livable wage, you would think that would be a no-brainer. And, you know, yeah.
Well, and you'd think also it would make sense to invest in it, right? It's like, this is your product. Why wouldn't you put it in the absolute best? Why wouldn't you? If you bought a Lamborghini, but you weren't ready to drive it yet, you wouldn't put the bad fuel in it and leave it outside under the carport, right? You'd take care of it. And so if you get an 18, 19-year-old kid, don't you want them to have the best nutrition and not to be selling insurance in the off season or having to worry about living in an apartment with seven dudes? Wouldn't you want them to just focus on getting really good at baseball so they can steal first base? I just think it's a short-sighted developmental thing, and it's just going to take one team to be like, hey, you know what? We're going to pay. We're going to pay our guys. What do you need? We'll pay you insurance or whatever. And once that happens, and maybe if they win, then people copy. But it's going to take an owner and an ownership group who has the financial foresight to recognize it as a business break, or they're just going to have to bribe Congress to give them some sort of tax loophole. probably more likely.
You know, anything's possible. I mean, you're talking about organizations. You know, when Frank McCourt owned the Dodgers, I used to negotiate with one of the guys in their minor league system who, even though we were in San Bernardino, it was 110 degrees, refused to buy Gatorade for the team. $100 for the Gatorade I couldn't get for the team when it was sweltering because McCourt wouldn't write the check for it. So,
well, as it turned out, he didn't have the money.
No, exactly. You know, I guess fair point, really. I mean, who would have ever thought? Yeah. And then of course, he sells the team and makes what off of that deal? Basically by running it to the ground. Anyway.
Never should have been allowed to have a team because he didn't have the money and use that lack of money to make $1 billion that he then gave to his wife. So, ex-wife. it's a weird deal, man. It's a weird deal. And the funny thing is, all this stuff, whether you're talking about, you know, Trevor Bauer designing pitches in the new age of technology, not buying Gatorade, that's all stuff Jim Bowden was writing about in ball four.
Yeah.
Same stuff. You know, Johnny Stain with his ball and a stick. And literally, guys bringing Gatorade into the Seattle Pilots clubhouse and never getting reimbursed by the team owner. I mean, it's the same stuff all these years later. So,
who knows? Who would have ever thought in a million years the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Yeah. And you know what? Part of that is, like, for all of these very real issues, and sometimes I feel like I need a shower being part of the industry after a game, there are so many amazingly talented, especially young players right now, that take my breath away with the stuff that they can do on a baseball field that I still keep wanting to watch.
So if you were going to pay to watch one, who's your guy?
Well, Trout is in a class by himself to the point where when we were in Oakland, I was talking to some of the guys about Matt Chapman. So you guys in the Eastern Conference probably never get to see. This guy's ridiculous. And we don't get to see him that much either, but he's a freak. And one of his teammates is like, he's the best player in the game. And I go, better than Trout? And they're like, oh, well, Trout doesn't count. That's how good Mike Trout is, that other players don't even consider him when they start having these discussions because he's that much better than everybody else. But right there in your backyard, I mean, Bogart, Mookie Betts, Mookie's having it down here, but he's ridiculous, right? Impossible not to cheer for with the way he plays the game. Francisco Lindor is like that. Trout is ridiculous. Our guy Buxton is phenomenal. Max Kepler is a great player to watch play. Matt Chapman is really, really good. Alex Bregman is a ridiculously talented young player. I mean, there are some dudes out there that are really, really fun to watch.
Do you think, because Rob Manfred, your favorite guy, Manfred seems to like to put it at the feet of the players that the players are not as good at marketing themselves as they should be. I think a case could be made that Rob Manfred is not as good at marketing the players as he could be.
Well, they don't want to market the players because that's power for the players. And again, it all goes back to this collective bargaining agreement where Tony Clark got run circles around in the last CBA where the players got they took their meal money, cut it in half, put ATM machines outside the clubhouse, and extra bus seat in spring training, and in return they just got hosed for like five more years. And that's every time that they get out lawyered, and certainly Rob's a good lawyer, they get out lawyered and then the league does a little dance on their grave and celebrates and it makes it more acrimonious. It's stupid because there's billions to be made for both sides. And if they can just kind of pretend to get along, and instead it seems like they're intent on right now saying, well, we're not going to pay you for the first 6 years. That's when you're cheap. And we've decided a smart business decision is not to pay you then. After that, we'll just get the next batch of cheap players unless you're Bryce Harper. And from a business standpoint, it makes sense. But from a structural standpoint, the players are going, well, when are we supposed to get paid then? Historically, they were always underpaid, and then they were overpaid because they got paid for what they did while they were underpaid, and then it balanced out in the long run. And I understand from a business side why you're not signing a 31-year-old free agent to a monster deal. But the way it's set up now, the players really back themselves into a corner. And instead of saying, like, oh, you know what, you're right, for the long-term good of all involved, let's kind of maybe figure out how to tweak that. It's like, tough. What are you going to do about it? And that's not – nobody wins. Nobody wins with that. So I do think they do a very poor job of marketing some really, really bright, talented, smiling. You can see their faces on TV. I mean, I know Tim is, oh, the games are too long. But no, more Mike Trout is good for me. More Mike Trout is good for me. And he shouldn't have to go out and become have his own YouTube channel to market himself, because baseball should be just eager to understand, like, oh, my gosh, he's a really good dude. He's never in trouble. He does everything exactly the way we always claim we want people to do it. But what we claim we want people to be and what we actually like as a fan base, always very different things, right? Someone told me the other day, they're like, well, Joe Mauer was everything that fans want. I go, no, he wasn't. He's anything that fans claim they want. A nice guy who's a good family man and stays at home. But they ripped him all the time. But if he had hit 40 home runs and his girlfriend, he probably would have been, everyone would love him. It's like that's the double standard in fandom. So it's a weird thing.
All right, man. Well, always a pleasure to talk to you. I wish I could do it more. I wish we could sit there and watch a ball game together, but you're always busy. So thank you for the time. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy floating down a creek with your kid. That should be an awesome afternoon.
We are going to look out for the 70-inch sturgeon that somehow ended up in a in a Minneapolis watershed. Somehow, some way, it's like the Ruth Bader Ginsburg of sturgeon. It's just alone, it's the creek, keeping the order, and we're gonna try not to get eaten by it.
All right, man. Well, we appreciate it and enjoy it. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, we'll talk to you later.
All right, buddy. That was Chris Atterbury, one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins. I really think he needs his own show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, just let him. Like, I don't know. He needs to be a podcast superstar. He could like give him a big bottle of Jack Daniels, he'd be Brockmire.
Yeah, that was fun. I enjoyed hearing his thoughts, and I really am aligned with him on a lot of his views.
He's quick. Like, just the analogy, like, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, all right, my USC degree in a room with Princeton and Stanford's on the phone in Minnesota. I'm like, I'm overmatched.
Yeah, no.
I can't even string a sentence together. what day is it again? It's Friday. So anyway, Chris Atterbury with the Twins, always enjoyable to hear his views on all the things. Now I got to do some Googling to see if I can find the 70-inch sturgeon that somehow emerged in a creek in Minneapolis. So with that said, we'll take a break. Come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen. We are joined by Doug Greenwald, a man who, I'll say it, he's been the broadcaster for the Fresno Grizzlies for quite some time, the AAA affiliate of the Washington Nationals, but I am guaranteeing you have more pictures of post offices on your phone than any other human being on the planet.
I'd certainly say I'd be up there on that list. I'll confess to that. Including quite a few from New Hampshire. So,
seriously, okay. So, I mean, how did that whole thing start? This is a completely random sidebar. How did you wind up taking pictures of post offices?
You know, just a lot of the traveling I do around the country, it's sort of a fun way to show where you've actually been. Because often you travel the country and you go to the interstate, and you know, that's fine. People might say, well, yeah, have you, been to Durham? You've been to Portsmouth? Oh, yeah. Passed through there on 95 and all that. Well, okay, yeah, but that's not really being there. You stop on the side of the road to get gas or get something to eat. I mean, that's not really being there to see the town. You got a picture of the post office. That's proof you're really there. So that's really how it started. There's a lot of very pretty old post office buildings, certainly a ton in New England. They go back almost 100 years. So just different kinds of geography in each section of the country. And as they say, you know, the postal system, I love U.S. history, goes back, obviously, you know, toward, you know, the Civil War era and all that. So it's sort of a great way to track the history of the country and track where you've actually been.
So, and it's funny, because every time I see a unique post office, you pop into my head.
Yeah.
It's what I think of. But I mean, it really does kind of identify a place and identify in a lot of cases the architecture and attention to detail or lack thereof, that a place might have. And it really carries that identity. But you know, I'll leave that topic for now. For you being the PCL, this has been, a year. And we just talked to Chris Atterbury with the Twins about a lot of the young players in minor league baseball or in major league baseball, the guys who are really up and coming that are certainly making their way in the major leagues now. Who have you seen as some of the up and comers in the PCL this year?
Well, obviously, it started with our team in Fresno, Carter Kibu, who was up briefly this year with Washington. He was the number one pick a couple of years ago by the Nationals. Drafted as a shortstop, but the Nats have him playing a lot of second. Now he's starting to play a little bit of third because, you know, if he goes back up right now, that's a stacked infield with Rendon and, you know, Turner and, you know, Howie Kendrick and guys like that. So they have him, you know, dancing around the infield a little bit. But, you know, obviously, guys, in addition from my team, Zach Gallen, who's now in the big leagues with Miami, got his first big league win the other night. He was off to a blazing start in New Orleans. He was like 8-1 and faced us and struck out 11 Fresno players in about a 6-inning or 7-inning span, and he was up the big leagues not too far after that. You know, seeing was up with the Dodgers a little bit this year, and then came back. Will Smith, the catcher with Oklahoma City, who's come back and hit a bunch of home runs for the Triple-A Dodgers. So, you know, those are a few of the guys that we've seen this year. A catcher by the name of Austin Allen, who was up with San Diego this year. He was here with El Paso much of the year. He's performed quite well. You know, Luis Urias, an infielder who's now up in the big leagues with San Diego. He was up a little bit last season. Obviously, it's always fun to see guys get a chance to go up. But that's just an example of some of the guys we've seen.
Doug, you mentioned one of the players that's gone between Fresno and Washington, D.C., and growing up here in New England, where the Red Sox have the Sea Dogs in Maine and the Pawtucket team close by, I'm wondering what it's like to have the AAA team all the way across the country. Where, I mean, these post offices in Fresno and D.C. are quite a ways apart. What's it like being part of the organization where the Major League team is so far away?
Well, let's put it this way. Every time, with the imbalance of wins, or the imbalance of teams, 16 to 14, in AAA, there's always going to be an odd duck geographically. And this year it does. It had been Houston this year, but the odd duck was the mess in Las Vegas for many years. Now with the A's being in Vegas, which certainly makes more sense geographically, we're the odd duck. And when Washington got, when Syracuse got bought by the Mets a little over a year ago, that forced Washington needing a home. We were supposed to have the Brewers, and at the last minute, they went to San Antonio because they had been in Colorado Springs. The Colorado Springs franchise moved to San Antonio, so the Brewers just decided to keep that contract or renew that contract. So Washington needed a home, and we needed an affiliate, and that's what happened. So here's the trick, Warren. What happens is if a player needs to go up, and you're going to certainly specifically Fresno to D.C., Fresno has a nightly red eye to Chicago. So the player's on that red eye and gets to obviously change planes and connects to D.C. in the morning or wherever the Nationals are playing. So that's essentially how you do it.
That's a long way to go, and it's certainly not as convenient as it could be. We're here with Doug Greenwald, the voice of the Fresno Grizzlies. And, you know, I think about my days back in Hagerstown when we were the Giants affiliate. It was tough to explain to people. I think a lot of people up in Maryland had no idea that the San Francisco Giants had ever moved from New York back in the 50s. So there's always going to be a bit of a learning curve that goes along with that. For you now, the names that you throw out, Round Rock, Texas, Fresno, California is your home base. But I mean, it really is to a lot of us pinpoints all over the map, and you're the voice of the University of Nevada women's basketball team as well. What's in the years that you've been doing this, what's your favorite, I guess, place to call a game and town to visit?
I would say within the Pacific Coast League, Memphis, because the ballpark is so beautiful there. And the Pacific Coast League over the last year just has a kind of resurgence of gorgeous ballparks, and specifically downtown ballparks, whether it be Nashville or El Paso. Las Vegas has a new ballpark this year. It's not in downtown Las Vegas. It's in downtown Summerlin, which is a section of Las Vegas. But I'd say Memphis overall, because the ballpark's 20 years old, but it still looks like it's new. There's been remodeling, but it sits right there downtown, and you can walk from the hotel, and then after the game, there's tons of places to eat that are, symbolize Memphis with the soul food and with the ribs and the barbecue and all that. And the blues music and everything is just right there. It's like an event, as opposed to having to drive to a stadium that sits on an interstate.
Right.
So a lot of great places to go. And New Orleans is a fun place to go. I love New Orleans, but they're losing their franchise this year. They're going to move into Wichita. And unfortunately, baseball just isn't really the thing to do there in New Orleans. But Memphis has always been a fun place. I've always enjoyed visiting there.
Well, were you around back in the days of old Tim McCarver Stadium before? Is it still AutoZone Park out there?
Still AutoZone Park. Unfortunately, I never made it to Tim McCarver Stadium. I really wish I could have. I am a still understanding.
It was a place that had a lot of personality, and I think I may have been there in the last season that it was in use because they had models out of AutoZone State of AutoZone Park and what it was going to look like and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head as far as Memphis for the food and the culture that goes along with it. It's a lot of fun to go and experience that. We're not terribly far from there, and it's always kind of, it's always on our minds as somewhere to go. The thing that you mentioned sort of in passing within that is the fact that New Orleans doesn't draw terribly well, and as a result, can you imagine being a AAA ball player and thinking, okay, one year you're playing in New Orleans and it's nightlife and everything that goes along with it, and then the next year you get sent down and you're in Wichita?
I think baseball-wise it's going to be better, though. I know that those aren't comparable cities in terms of tourist destinations, but regarding what baseball is about in the minor leagues from a player standpoint, and that's development, and getting a chance to play in front of better crowds and nicer venues. What Wichita is doing is they're tearing down Old Lawrence Newmont Stadium and rebuilding on that site. So it'll be a completely new stadium, and it's going to be one where affiliated baseball is going to be back in Wichita for the first time in probably, 12 years or so, I think. So I think it's going to be a much, much better situation.
It seems that it might be, and probably easier for a player to focus on playing the game. Far fewer distractions in Wichita than in New Orleans. We're with Doug Greenwald, the voice of the Fresno Grizzlies, a man who has, I remember back in the days when I was in Kansas City and, I'd get the phone call, hey, I'm in town, let's go grab some food. We did it seemingly without fail when you were up there, I believe, calling Centenary games and visiting UMKC. But when you're not behind a mic, what else do you like to do when you're on the road? I don't think people realize, if they've never done what you do, it's for a few months out of the year, it's a complicated existence.
It is, and a lot of behind the scenes stuff that the common fan doesn't see, especially in the Pacific Coast League, when you have a night game, and by the time the game is over, then you still leave the ballpark for another hour because you have a post-game show. Then you have to pack up all your equipment, get it downstairs. You get home, but let's say, because pretty much every game we play is over 3 hours these days. You get home at midnight, and then you turn around. You're at the ballpark by 4 o'clock in the morning to catch your bus to go to the airport for a 6 a.m. flight. And sometimes you get to travel on the off day. You're still up early, but at least you get to an off day. You get to a city early on the day off, and that's fine because you'd rather have that to play the day of the game. But, just for the most part, I like to take in what a city's about. I mean, as I say, there's some places like a Memphis where you have everything sitting right there for you to do walking distance. So I think a lot of our guys in the league, a common topic we all like, Lauren, is food.
Yep.
So we often will talk about what, what restaurants are open, or not open, but what restaurants might be new, or if there's a hole-in-the-wall place, we'll talk about that. But, we enjoy, maybe seeing a museum, or in my case, driving around and hitting all the as many of the little towns as possible. I mean, we go to Texas on our next trip, which includes Round Rock and San Antonio, with off days on each side, and I'm going to stay the extra off day on the back end. And who knows how many post offices I'm going to get down in Central Texas. but it just, you just, as I say, you take advantage of things like that. I mean, you still have a job to do. I mean, you still have to be at the ballpark at, several hours ahead of time. I mean, there's still preparation involved there. It's not like I'm showing up at 6:45 to flip the switch and get on the air for a 7 o'clock game.
No.
Trust me, I'm not. So you got to plan your day accordingly. So if I want to do some things, I'm going to have to be up early and maybe leave at 9 in the morning and make sure I know that you're at the ballpark by 4. I think that's what a lot of us do is just maybe rent a car and go and explore a little bit. I say that's all part of it. San Antonio's a new city in our league after 100-plus years in AA. In the Texas League, they're now at AAA. That's the franchise that moved from Colorado Springs. So I've been to San Antonio a lot, but a lot of the guys in our league don't know what it's about, so I've been filling them in a little bit.
Wait a second. I completely forgotten about that. So you get a dose of Mike Sager every time you go there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm going to put up with Mike.
Yeah.
It's funny because I've actually seen him once this year. Inadvertently, during our All-Star break, I took 4 days. We have a 4-day break, so I took that break to go watch more games in the Southern League, just to see some ballparks and different sites around the country, see some of the radio broadcasting friends with those teams. And I fly to New Orleans, took that red eye I was talking about from Fresno and through Chicago and to Houston and Houston and New Orleans. So before I drove over to Mobile, I stopped briefly at the ballpark in New Orleans because they were playing on that Sunday. San Antonio having me in town, so I went over to see Mike, who I've known for about 20 years. But a great, great guy, and obviously very happy for him because that automatically, with San Antonio going AAA, automatically gave him a promotion for a team that he didn't have to, with a job where he didn't have to apply.
Yep. Sager used to be, for Hanson's edification, Sager was the broadcaster when I was in Inland Empire as the GM. And Sager was... It's funny, you talk to people about Sager because he is technically a great broadcaster, but like me, he grew up in Southern California and sounded a lot like Vin Scully. And so the knock on Sager, if you can believe it, was that he sounded too much like Vin Scully to get a job. And then, of course, he wound up moving to AA San Antonio, which was owned by the same ownership group that Inland Empire was. And then when the team moved up AA to AAA, he... took the elevator ride up. So one more question before we let you go. In all the years that you've been in baseball, who is the nicest ball player that you've ever come across?
Well, there's a lot of them, but I'd say who I stayed friends with and I've been with at just about every level. A guy who happens to be from New England, played baseball and football at UMass, Doug Clark, played briefly in the big leagues with the Giants and A's, and is the Giants minor league hitting coach for their rookie team in the Northwest League up in Salem, Kaiser, Oregon. Doug and I, when I was a student at Boston U, I did for 1 year the public address for football, and of course, B no longer has football, but Doug was a wide receiver at UMass, and a few years later, I'm in Stockton, and he's playing at Bakersfield, the Giants system. I'm thinking, well, the name sounds familiar, and I'm sure there's a lot of Doug Clarks, but
right.
But when I read his bio, and I said, oh, good football, UMass, now I remember, calling his name on the PA, so I introduced myself to him, and we became friendly, even though we were on opposite sides of the field, so to speak. The following year, I ended up broadcasting Shreveport, and figured there's going to be a good chance Doug's going to be promoted to Shreveport, so I see him at minor league spring the following following year. He says, hey, good to see you again. You know, you're back in stock. I said, no, get this. I'm in Shreveport now. He says, you got to be kidding me. You know, because I'm going to Shreveport. So we obviously got to know each other a lot better then. And then he was again in Shreveport. And then eventually I go to Fresno. He gets promoted to Fresno. and then he took him about 8 years to get to the big leagues. And in 2005, he had a tremendous year in AAA, but still didn't get called up initially. And the Giants had some injuries in September, and they brought him up. And one of my biggest thrills was when he came in from, I think he flied in from Hartford because he's from Springfield. I met him at his hotel in downtown San Francisco. And the night before his big league debut, he and I had a late night meal. And then the next day, I was at his major league debut. And we still had dinner that night with my family. And it was just such a big thrill because, you see, he's such a great person. He's got a great family. And how hard he worked for that moment. He's a great role model for everybody. Even to the point where when he was told of his first big league call-up, the Giants had to contact him while he was substitute teaching. So great story and one of the really nicest guys you'll ever come across.
Well, we're talking to one of them right now. So, Doug Greenwald, thank you for the time. It's always great to see your face. Hopefully, we'll get to do it again soon.
Yeah, hopefully I'll get back up your way. We're great to see the two of you. Thank you.
All right, my friend. Take care. Thank you for the time.
All right, you're welcome, Mark.
Bye-bye. That was Doug Greenwald, the voice of the Fresno Grizzlies, joining us on the air. And always, he's one who he's had some time in the major leagues, has enjoyed the experience up there, but really is a guy who enjoys going point to point and checking out all the outposts of America. And it's interesting to see all the places he's been. I think I've been a lot of places. It pales in comparison to where he's been.
Yeah, definitely. And the last thing you're talking about there, being in Shreveport, that was one of the teams we played when I was in San Angelo. So I wonder if we crossed paths without knowing it.
It very well may have been. So I know we had a bunch of topics that we wanted to go through. We are currently at, where are we? Maybe 19 and a half, going on 20 minutes plus the 34 that we took. So we got about 5 minutes. So what do you want to hit?
Well, we could...
We got 5 minutes.
We could do a quick, since this is a baseball show, we could do a quick Red Sox-Yankees update from yesterday. The stat of the week, couple stats of the week.
Okay, go.
All right, so Red Sox win 19-3.
Yep.
So it's the biggest run differential the Red Sox have ever had against the Yankees.
Okay.
Biggest win ever.
Okay.
Okay, so that's kind of fun. Second fun stat is that Red Sox had 8 players last night with 2 RBIs or more, which ties a major league record. A couple of fun things in there. First of all, you'd think that at least once a team would have had 9 players get 2 RBIs, especially with the DH. But this is the most that's ever happened is 8. And then the other fun thing about how the Red Sox got 8 players to 2 RBIs yesterday, the 4, 5, 6 hitters, none of them got 2 RBI. But somehow they had 8 players get 2 RBI because pinch hitters for the in the one
just
hole.
Just a bizarre artifact, but yeah.
The one hole, the 3 hole, and somewhere else came off the bench and had enough at-bats in that blowout to get 2 RBI. So there you go.
That's, yeah. Only in those games, too. And I was watching the first inning, and we actually had a brief kid-free moment and went out and grabbed something to eat. And sitting there in the bar, it became pretty obvious that it was going to be a blowout. And, like, you blink and you look back at the TV and it's 7-0. And, yeah, it will be interesting to see because to Chris Atterbury's point from earlier in the show, the Yankees' bullpen was decimated after that Twins series. You talk about that, I think the 14-12 or 12-10 game that Aaron Hicks made the diving catch in left center field to rob Kepler of extra bases and really a game-winning catch for the Yankees. But it wasn't an easy sequence for their pitching staff by any means.
Yeah, did you hear the fun stat from that Twins-Yankees game in terms of blowing leads? Second time a major league team has ever blown a lead in the top of the eighth, the bottom of the eighth, the top of the ninth, and the bottom of the ninth.
I thought it happened in the World Series to the Dodgers against the Astros. Am I hallucinating?
Probably felt like it, right?
Every World Series
yeah, some of
feels
those
like
games
that for the Dodgers.
Were pretty classic.
The other interesting thing, I guess, that happened in baseball this week, it happened yesterday in that Angels-Orioles game. Where the first time since the save is an official statistic that a position player picked up a save. Stevie Wilkerson for the Orioles did it yesterday, throwing no harder than about, basically his ball wouldn't have gotten a ticket on 93 South, just north of Concord.
That's not good.
No.
For velocity.
No. He was throwing 53, 54 miles an hour.
Was he throwing knuckleballs?
I don't think so. He was just sort of lobbing them in there.
Yeah, I heard that he got the save. I didn't see any of the details of how he got it or what he was looking like on the mound.
Yeah, there was, it was, he certainly wasn't rocking and firing. He was throwing in the 50s, but hey, worked for him. He got a save out of it. The last thing that I want to leave on, you had something, because this is like one of our favorite topics, or at least mine, Jeopardy James.
Oh, yeah. And we got to bring this up, because you talk about strategy with Chris Atterbury, which I think is really the one of the most exciting things about sports is how are different teams going to strategize based on the rules, based on the players they have. And then, of course, Jeopardy James revolutionized how you play the game of Jeopardy because of his strategy.
Yep.
And then here we go with the announcement of the Jeopardy Tournament of Champions coming up, where he'll be back on the show. And he sees the rules for the prize money. The rules as stated are that the winner of this Tournament of Champions event, first place gets a fixed prize of $250,000.
Yep.
Second place gets $100,000 or their final score, whichever is higher. And so if you just take that at face value, you might think, well, all right, great. I'm going for the quarter million. I won first place.
Right.
But not Jeopardy James. He thinks about the strategy a little bit more to figure out what he wants to do.
Right.
Which is come in second place.
And win more than $250,000.
Right. So if the winner gets $500,000 and he comes in second with $490,000, he's going to walk with $490,000. The winner's only going to get $250,000.
It's brilliant. I love it. Okay, so my next question is, because we threw this out there, 1 in 8 men think that they could win a point from Serena Williams.
Yes.
I don't think I could win a point from Serena.
Well, you're only on one knee. If you had two good knees, do you think you could?
I don't think I could even with two good knees.
I think I could. I'm going to say yes.
I don't see it. So but the other stat that goes along with it is, so that's 1 in 8 is 12.5%. 3% of women, this is the unreported stat, 3% of women think that they could win a point from Serena.
Yeah, that's fine. I like that.
Okay.
What percentage of adult women play tennis in the U.S.?
I don't know.
Maybe it's 3%.
I don't know. But so if you haven't gone and watched that Dude Perfect video with Serena, have you seen it? I'm pointing at Maggie. She's in here. It's really good. Like, it's just like witchcraft of watching her hit tennis balls. So do you think it would be more likely that you would get a question right playing against Jeopardy James or be able to win a point from Serena?
Oh, I mean, I'm one of those optimistic people. I think I could do both.
Okay, so, all right, you're putting both at 100. Well, I think I would be more likely to get a question right against James.
But is that you know it and he doesn't, or that you beat him on the buzzer?
Beat him on the buzzer and get it right, and I'm not just sitting there getting carpal tunnel from pressing the button.
I don't know, and that's I hadn't thought about that twist. That's a good question. But against Serena, I mean, it kind of depends on if you're serving or if she's serving. If she's serving, she can get a double fault. But if you're serving and you hit a perfect serve up the middle with a little hook, you can get an ace against her.
Okay, but chances are that I'm not even going to hit her second serve. Yeah.
You would.
No, the double fault is a possibility.
You can hit a curveball.
You can dodge a wrench. You can dodge a ball. Well, I did the other night in Jeopardy bust out the double Jeopardy or the final Jeopardy question, much to my surprise. My wife was shocked.
See, there you go.
Yeah, anyway. On that note, thank you to our guests, Chris Atterbury of the Minnesota Twins, Doug Greenwald of the Fresno Grizzlies. Thank you to my co-host, Andrew Hansen, for always doing a bang-up job with research, even though we only had to use like 5 minutes of research today. Thank you to everybody here at the station, Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, and Colleen Richardson. And thank you to you guys for listening. Have a lovely sports weekend. Stay cool. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.